Hello, I'm Marek Schneider. Welcome to this podcast of articles from the Wall Street Journal, a presentation of AIRS LA. You are listening to this recording, which is provided for the use of those who are blind or print impaired. Materials or items read on AIRS LA are the copyrighted property of the original authors and publishers. No unauthorized use or duplication is permitted. Today's first article is titled, When McDonald's Was an Inexpensive Treat, by Bob Green. Then Sabrina Siddiqui and Sarah Ashley O'Brien wrote, RFK Jr. Wants to Ease Market Barriers as Peptide Popularity Grows. We'll follow that up with an article by Erica Kamazar, Don't Fool Around with FAFO, FAFO Parenting. Jack Butler has an article, The Crowded House I Call Home, and we'll follow that up with one by Brenda Cronin, A Sure Bet on a Bad Trend. All these articles are from recent editions of the Wall Street Journal. So let's begin with today's first one, When McDonald's Was an Inexpensive Treat. We carried the empty paper bag home with us on the plane, taking care not to rip it and then pasted it into our scrapbook. Our father and mother, in the spring of 1958, had taken my sister, my brother, and me to Florida. We saw flamingos and acrobatic water skiers for the first time, but all we could chatter about on the flight home to Ohio was the exotic new place where we had stopped on our way to the Tampa airport. The white takeout bag was proof we had been there in case our friends back home doubted us. On it was a cartoon likeness of a smiling, winking chef with a face shaped like a hamburger bun, and in big red letters, the word McDonald's. Like most Americans, we had never been in a McDonald's, though rumors of their existence were rampant. The Tampa Tribune, when the city's outlet opened that March in 1958, reported that there were 80 of them in the United States, compared with about 13,500 today. Food already cooked and waiting as you walked up to the counter, prices so low as to be irresistible. And here a McDonald's was, right on South Dale Mabry Highway, as my dad drove us by in our rental car. He hit the brakes. In the scrapbook, we would write, we had 6 hamburgers, 4 cheeseburgers, 4 orders of French fries, and 3 milkshakes. Total cost of dinner for our family of 5, $2.66. That was the gimmick that talked about secret to McDonald's growing success. 15-cent hamburgers, 19-cent cheeseburgers, 10-cent fries, 20-cent milkshakes, ready for your arrival. The cartoon chef's name was Speedy, and Speedy service was the McDonald's promise. This month, across the United States, McDonald's has been introducing its largest burger ever. Called the Big Arch, the double patty burger packs 1,020 calories and sells for about $9, or about 5 times the price of that original 1958 hamburger after inflation, though prices do vary by location. Because of its eye-popping cost, the new burger is drawing considerable attention. Great ideas dazzle once and only once, the first time you experience them. And McDonald's great idea, brilliant in its simplicity, was rock-bottom prices and the assembly line efficiency that offered exactly 9 items, 6 of them drink. You knew as you rolled up what you were getting and that it was going to be so inexpensive, you did not have to think twice. Walk into a McDonald's today and you'll find a menu with around 140 items, including combo meals. Yet somehow there's no dazzle in the experience. The $9 Big Arch is more likely to prompt an arch of the eyebrow, a decidedly non-golden arch. McDonald's rightfully became McDonald's because of its founding, world-changing idea, and all this is distant from that. Our part of Ohio did not get a McDonald's until the early 1960s. But my sister, my brother, and I felt like pioneers. We had come across something that felt entirely new and brought the evidence home from far away, Dale Mabry Highway, to preserve in that scrapbook. a white paper bag, Speedy the chef, and a bedazzling roadside memory. And now RFK wants to ease market barriers as peptides' popularity grows. Peptides made in China come in tiny glass bottles with names like Glowstack and Wolverine Stack. They promise youthful skin and speedy muscle recovery, delivers in injectable form. Influencers, celebrities, and everyday people are raving about these unapproved drugs. Now they have an ally in Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who wants to make peptides easier and legal to buy. Kennedy is poised to take action that would allow compounding pharmacies to make certain peptides that are currently restricted by the Food and Drug Administration, people familiar with the matter said. Peptides make up a broad category that includes FDA-approved drugs, supplements, and experimental treatments. Technically speaking, peptides are short chains of amino acids that act as messengers in the body. But today, peptide has become shorthand for an injectable drug that has not undergone FDA approval. Sold primarily through an online gray market where they are labeled for research use only, the vials can run from tens to hundreds of dollars a piece. Influencers and podcasters have cast these drugs as a way to look and feel amazing. This is my skin before taking GHK, said a 22-year-old living in Austin, Texas, goes by the name of Greta Devereaux on TikTok. She has shared a before and after with her 59,000 followers. Her face, once splotchy with some acne scarring, is now clear, bronzed, and glowing. She credited to GHK-CU, one of the restricted peptides sold as a standalone, as well as part of what is known as the Glow Stack. Kennedy has called himself a big fan of these alternative therapies and promised to end the war on peptides. In a recent interview on Joe Rogan's podcast, Kennedy unveiled plans to lift restrictions on more than a dozen peptides that he claimed were illegally recategorized under the Biden administration. Kennedy appeared to be referring to roughly 17 peptides the FDA reclassified back in 2023, citing potential significant safety risks barring compounding pharmacies from making them. Kennedy, who told Rogan he has used peptides himself to treat unspecified injuries, did not offer further details on what steps he might take. At least two career staffers at the FDA, whose work includes compounding drugs, said they learned of the health secretary's plans to take action on peptides only from his appearance on the podcast. People familiar with the plan said the administration's goal is to let compounders make the banned peptides again, and shut down a gray market of products. Some within the FDA are worried about increasing access to untested treatments. Before the 2023 restrictions, pharmacies were able to compound peptides that had been prescribed by a physician. Since the FDA moved away from them to its Do Not Formulate list, online sellers have cashed in on selling unregulated peptides, most of them from Chinese suppliers. Americans are at greater risk from the gray market than they will be if a state-licensed, legitimate compounding pharmacy is preparing these drugs, said Scott Bruner, chief executive of the Alliance for Pharmacy Compounding, a trade group. Others said the idea that Americans would be safer getting unapproved peptides from compounders does not make sense. How is that different from saying, we don't legalize raiding bank vaults, people will just rob banks, said Shabir Imber Safdar, executive director of the Partnership for Safe Medicines, a public health coalition that focuses on supply chain safety. Andrew Nixon, a spokesman at HHS, declined to share specifics about Kennedy's plans, but alluded to concern about people accessing peptides through the gray market. Now we have Erica Komisar, Don't Fool Around with FAPO Parenting. The latest child-rearing fad, the Wall Street Journal reports, is FAPO Parenting. Let's hope it passes quickly. The spelled out acronym is unprintable in a family newspaper, but we'll approximate it as fool around and find out. It elevates consequences over the gentle parenting methods that have helped shape Generation Z, according to the journal. Didn't feed the dog? No food for you. Realize a particular after-school activity is not for you? Tough luck. You'll do it until you pay for the gear we bought. While these tactics may be deployed in a spirit of tough love or humor, it can fuse humiliation for discipline. There's a difference between natural consequences and manufactured punishments designed for shock value. The former teaches responsibility, the latter erodes trust. As a psychoanalyst and parent guidance specialist, I've worked with thousands of families. Parents struggle most when they are either too permissive or too punitive. Effective child rearing consists in neither indulgence nor oppression, but co-regulation, emotional attunement, and empathic setting of boundaries. Too much permissiveness can fail to provide children the limits they need to feel safe and the skills they need to solve problems and become productive adults. They can turn into public nuisances who never truly learn empathy. Yet raising children is not about control. It's about connection with accountability. Children need to feel emotionally safe to regulate their own emotions and behavior. When they misbehave, they should face consequences, ones that are logical, proportional, respectful, and age appropriate. In my practice, I encourage parents to remain firm while staying emotionally available. Take strength to hold the boundary while staying calm and empathic in the face of child distress. We need to treat our children in the same respectful way we would handle a disagreement with an adult partner. This parenting method, a balance of warmth and structure, is the most effective and healthiest approach, according to decades of research. Children raised with a blend of empathy and expectations grow up more emotionally resilient, independent, and capable of navigating the world that does not require yelling, shame, or punitive theatrics. Parents are exhausted. Many are overwhelmed by contradictory advice and their children's behavioral challenges. But being an effective parent is not about being soft or hard. It's about being present, grounded, and emotionally available while holding firm to the boundaries that teach children how to live. Leading by example and with empathy takes more work than FAPO, but it's better for our children and for us. Now we have the crowded house I call home. The house I grew up in is usually quiet nowadays, but every few months it roars with life, as it did this past weekend. It was a noisy and chaotic abode when I grew up there as the youngest of five siblings. All of us were born within an 8-year spread, so we had ample time together under its roof. Lots of holidays and dinners, play with every possible combination of siblings, movie nights, some of which I was excluded from for being too young. But when the basement lights were off and the others were distracted, a 4-year-old could hide on the stairs and peep over the railing to see all of Titanic, rated PG-13, by the way. A full house can get tense. A sibling pair usually had to share a bedroom. Sustained proximity drive even family members to occasional madness. There were never enough bathrooms. We always seemed to be almost late to wherever we needed to go. Even I, the baby, made contributions. As one dinner began, my family unhappily discovered I poked a hole in the crust of a loaf of bread and hollowed out its soft inside for my own enjoyment. As I became a teenager and a cross-country runner, complaints were raised about my various odors. The complaints were not unwarranted. As years passed, one sibling after another left, the house becoming a little more quiet with each departure. Previously, you struggled to find a place to escape the din. My preference, a Harry Potter-like nook under the aforementioned basement stairs. But the older I got, the more silent it became, until I too joined my siblings out in the world. My parents now have the house to themselves, except when we come back. We often do, despite being scattered coast to coast. The occasions are sometimes sorrowful, as each of our grandparents, once special visitors to the house, passed away. We came together in grief. More often, though, we reunite to celebrate milestones. This past weekend, it was a wedding shower. Around this time last year, it was a baby shower. Some celebrations bring a fresh perspective to our recollections. Adults can't forget how magical Christmas is for children. Do you see nieces and nephews experience that magic anew? Watching a new generation make memories, we hope these moments will one day be recalled as fondly as our own memories are. Our now expanding family makes the house more crowded and multifaceted than ever. When we reunite, my old bedroom becomes a nursery. With more mouths to feed, the kitchen becomes a restaurant. The basement, now equipped with weights and a Peloton, serves as a gym for different family members' workouts. And we test the limits of how much work from home one house can take, turning it into a WeWork space. Alas, these reunions are temporary. We have our own lives, some of them hundreds or thousands of miles away. But each visit back reminds us of what we share, and each visit back makes us look forward to what we will share in the future, such as, if we're lucky, more trips to the house that still welcomes us home. And now we do have one more, a sure bet on a bad trend. In the 1995 movie Casino, Robert De Niro plays Sam Rothstein, who says his job managing the Tangiers Hotel and Casino in Las Vegas is like selling people dreams for cash. How much cash? Tons of it. I mean, what do you think we're doing out here in the middle of the desert? It's all this money. Today, there's no need to trek to the slot machines or blackjack tables to get in on the action. Just check your phone. The global betting buffet never closes, and with a few clicks, you're in. When I was reporting on Nobel Prize predictions years ago, I often cited the odds for potential winners. Outside the United States, some betting outfits that largely focused on horse races would also take wagers on the authors, scientists, and other public figures who might win. Few of these bets paid off, so the odds makers were seen less as clairvoyants than reliable indicators of who would not be accepting a medal in Stockholm. That long ago mishmash of horses, poets, and peacemakers seems quaint today. Our multi-billion dollar betting market now sprawls far beyond the Nobels, with sports just the slice of it. You can bet on Nepal's elections, which actor will play the next James Bond, the next cabinet member to exit the Trump administration, and even whether the United States will confirm before 2027 that extraterrestrials exist. In gambling, the downside for many is vast, while the upside favors few. In the end, the house always wins. How else would casinos in Monte Carlo, Macau, or online stay in business? As Rothstein asserts, it's all been arranged just for us to get your money. I have participated in office pools for March Madness and the Oscars. I have wagered on the Kentucky Derby. The Lexington Herald Leader was among the newspapers owned by the company in Washington where I began my career. A sports editor would place Derby bets for everyone back in the newsroom. I based my consistently bad calls, losing $5 or so, on the horse's name and the colors of the jockey's silks. Like the basketball and movie pools, it was fun that was soon forgotten. Not all gamblers stopped with a throwaway flutter, but even if things never got out of hand, is this a wise use of time? It's a risk, unlike, say, practicing a sport or taking up a new hobby. Your life won't crater because you can't stop playing the piano, practicing tennis serves, drilling irregular French verbs, or reading another page of Plutarch's Lives. I know a few gamblers who paid their law school tuition with poker table winnings before going on to dazzling careers. They harness card playing to productive ends, but few gamblers do. Is it harmless fun, like guessing about the Nobel, or not? When the industry euphemisms pile up, so do my doubts. Among the current panoply are prediction markets, event contracts, and event prediction, perhaps to attract a tech-savvy audience. Online marketplaces aren't seeking slot machine players as much as rookies eager to strike gold by tapping on their smartphones. Betting can be community building, proponents say. Like rooting for a team, gambling can connect people, especially the allegedly isolated, anxiety-ridden, and disputedly online members of Generation Z. The same arguments were made on behalf of social media, and we see how that's working out. Things could get a whole lot worse. I will bet on that. That brings us to the end of today's articles. I'm Merrick Schneider, and I will be back soon with more articles. Thank you for listening.